these informal classes at my house, there's part of me that just really wants to chant and not do any kind of donor talk, but I'm writing an article. It's on listening and the necessity and the medicine of listening, and how we actually don't listen so much in our culture. We tend to talk at rather than to each other, and I've just been thinking about it a lot, and thinking, of course, about the dharma of speech. But then there was just an article on the Yogananda's website, like the same day I was going to submit this article, that it doesn't even realize it's about the dharma of speech, but it is, so I didn't want to submit the same article. So I just kept sitting in this contemplation. And then last week, I had this kind of breakthrough about introducing the concept of, you know, the yogic concept of the mind, which we have talked about before in here, which, you know, the four-part psychic instrument is the technical term. And the more I've been thinking about that particular way of understanding the mind, the more inspired I've been feeling around when we factor that particular understanding in. I think it makes it more, it helps create the environment that we can actually sit back and listen. Because if you think about how you are in conversation, you know, we know this, we either self-reference, give advice, try to fix, dissociate. Well, those kinds of responses, rather than just actually take in what someone is saying and just feel that inside of us, and then let whatever response is going to come from that, come out of that taking in, deep listening. You know, we tend to be so reactive, and we tend to be defensive. Somebody says something we don't like, we'll go into reactive defensive mode, or we'll go into dissociation mode. If they say something we like, we might go into, depending on the state of our wounding, you know, we'll either go into like unworthiness and guilt and not take it in, and we'll go into grandiosity, you know, whatever. Whereas if we could just sort of take it in and say, thank you. You know, how many times you had the experience that somebody said, gave you a really lovely compliment, and you can't even just say, you know, you go into this whole, you really think so, and you know what I'm saying. So we don't just take in. And of course now we live in the information age, when we're being bombarded by input 24/7. And so we've already been hardwired to pretty much dissociate from a lot of what's coming in. And now on top of just what's coming in through the senses, I mean, if you ever stop to think about all the data that's just coming in through our senses, long before the information age ever happened, it's kind of overwhelming. And then you think about all the emotional stuff that's coming in, just in our interactions with other people. And then I've been thinking, even if I buy into the philosophy of Kashmir Shaivism, which I pretty much do, that says everything is alive and pulsating with consciousness, then everything is alive, right? When Muktananda gave us that teaching, I was like, oh my God, I'm home. Like, that struck me. It was the most radical thing I've ever heard, and it blew me out of the water. Right, everything is pulsating with consciousness. Everything is divine. Even what we don't think is, somewhere it is. And it's gotten me thinking about place. Again, because I'm thinking about listening, and I'm realizing, well, we start with listening to ourselves, of course, and the more we train ourselves to really listen to ourselves, which in itself is not that easy, because there's so many conflicting voices, and we have to really learn to hear the true voice, and not the chorus of wounding and wounded voices that tend to crowd the internal field. But then there's also, and of course, and listening to the mind, listening to the body, listening to, I mean, it's a pretty complex system. And then listening, and as we really begin to be able to listen to ourselves and really hear ourselves and just kind of be with that, whatever it is, And then we can begin to branch out and really listen to other people. And I was thinking, but what about the cats? Mm-hmm. I listen to them. And then I was thinking, like even food that, you know, that I'm cooking. Like I was making, I was making a rice salad the other day. So I'm peeling the cucumbers. And then I'm thinking, I think I'm hurting them. I need to be more gentle. You know, I need to peel these cucumbers with a lot more sensitivity to how it feels for them to get peeled and, you know, seared. And it's not like I'm becoming this weirdo that I can't ever eat anything again because I don't want it to damage. It was just more like, let me listen to the cucumber too. And then I was thinking, what about space? Like, if we really, I know some people, something shuts down when it comes to figuring out where to put the chair or the table or the lamp or whatever. As I'm sort of thinking about today, I'm thinking, if we really listen to the spaces that we live in, they'll probably tell us where whatever it is supposed to be, you know. And it's another way that we're not actually listening. We're not present in the totality of ourself and the totality of our relationships and the totality of our environment. So it's a very, very profound contemplation. And obviously, it's another way of doing mindfulness practice. But for me, of course, I have to complicate everything and make it more interesting. So I want to go on this contemplative journey about listening rather than just be present in the moment. So all of this has been percolating around inside of me. And then again, I have this whole about the mind. So let's just go back and review. In the yogic system, and you get this in Shaivism, you get this not quite exactly like this, but you get a version of this in the Yoga Sutra, and I'm sure it's somewhere in Vedanta, and you could probably even find it somewhere in Bhagavad Gita. It's pretty much, I mean, it's definitely in the Sankhya philosophical stream, but it just sort of crops up pretty much throughout the Hindu, and I think even in Buddhism also, systems of yoga. So the mind basically is conceived as having four parts. Manas, remember? Chitta. Mm-hmm. Remember ahamkar, the ego, the eye maker? Mm-hmm. And the buddhi, the intellect, discriminating faculty. So manas, chitta, ahamkar, and buddhi. And I've wrestled with manas and chitta for years, like what's the simplest way to explain them? And this week I finally realized, duh, manas is the conscious mind, period, end of sentence. And chitta is the unconscious mind. And again, ahamkar, as we know, is the eye maker, the ego. And buddhi is the discriminating faculty, or the intellect. So if you think of manas as the conscious mind, and we do really want to understand that the whole mind-body system is one big mind. It's like mind pervades the entire system here. So even though we may imagine that we're thinking up here, we're actually thinking in our whole body. It's all connected. But just for the sake of this little contemplation, if you think of manas as just your conscious mind, and then chitta think of as the unconscious, which is more, taking up a lot more space, and then the ego is just always running around inside of that looking for something it can grab hold of. And then the buddhi is trying to get a word in to just like make some order and sense and discrimination in this whole mess. And I think what generally happens in most of us is we are overextended with manas and ahamkar. Right? And most of us are just run ragged by the interaction of manas and ahamkar, right? The conscious mind and the ego. And the unconscious is doing a lot, but we're not even friggin' aware of it. And again, and then here's the poor buddhi just trying to, hello, what'd you just say yes for? You don't want to do this. Right? What the hell was that about? But we've already done it. So, When the mind-body system is in this condition of manas and ego basically running the show, with the unconscious, with citta, definitely having a very profound effect on everything. We're not even aware of it. And discrimination buried somewhere, buddhi buried somewhere where we can barely hear it. It's impossible for us to cultivate that kind of spaciousness where we can actually listen to ourselves and listen to other people. Because we have an interaction with someone, but the space isn't clear. Their manas and their citta are running all, you know, in our manas, and it's all interacting with each other. And then, you know, this, you know, ahamkar over here is vying with that ahamkar for who's going to be the most, who's going to dominate this conversation, you know, who's going to dominate this interaction. Everybody's buddhi is quietly freaking out somewhere, wishing the whole system would just, like, shut the hell up and get real. Yeah? Sound familiar?
Yeah.
So, in this context, in many ways we could say the goal of yoga, well, there's several goals of yoga. Obviously, and this is one of the things Patanjali really articulates in the Yoga Sutra, it's about cleansing the mind, the manas and the citta, so they shine like a clear crystal. Because in most of us, they're just all muddy, right? Manas is just, you know, and the unconscious is just like mud. I mean, there's so much. And that's the thing, because we're always taking in impressions, and everything gets stored. Everything. I was remembering earlier today, it was I was thinking about tonight and what I wanted to say. And I was thinking about buddhi. And I was remembering, when I was in elementary school, I don't remember what grade, but we were studying slavery. And I used to walk to school, and I used to sort of come out the back door of my house and cut through my neighbor's yard and then sort of around and down the hill to walk down to school. And I can still remember where I had this revelation just blasted up from inside of me, which was my buddhi, slavery is wrong. It was like every cell in my body knew that slavery was wrong. And I was probably, you know, like in second grade or something, and it's not like my I'm sure my teacher wasn't teaching it like it's a good thing, but whatever it was, everything in me just like got it, this is wrong. And that was discrimination, right? That was the buddhi just like, because I must have been thinking about it. It was sort of, it was percolating around in the manas. You know, they often translate manas as the mind stuff, but I think that's a little confusing. You know, it is, it's energy, and it's the energy the thought is made of. It's like, and then the words shape it. The words sort of shape manas into words, and then they get interpreted through buddhi and ahamkar. Usually, unfortunately, too much ahamkar, not enough buddhi. Buddhi's good at, you know, simple, you know, like that's a picture, that's a wall, these are women. It's fine when it's doing that. But when we want to go to the deeper, more refined discriminations, and that's when a lot of it gets covered over by ego. And it gets covered over by all the mishigas, mostly in citta, in the unconscious. Because there's so much unconscious blah-de-blah, you know, there's so much repressed emotion, you know, so much rage and despair and self-hatred and jealousy, and, you know, all the stuff that tends to just percolate around in the unconscious. Every now and then it comes up into the manas area, and then we, like, shove it right back down again, you know, because it's
what
not...
What about intuition?
Well, intuition and buddhi are very connected. Mm-hmm. I think in many ways we could say intuition is sort of the deep voice of the buddhi. And so back to my little weird diagram here. So if we think of the ego as kind of generating around the solar plexus, and that is, you know, as you all know, you know, we consider that the seat of power. And so that sense of I does begin, I am, and depending on where we are in our woundedness, that sense of power is completely disempowered, or, you know, or it can be empowered in grandiosity, you know, I mean, we've been talking about this stuff for years. So, and then underneath that is buddhi, and you know, buddhi becomes Buddha, right? I mean, buddhi is really what wakes up. So, and then underneath that is the light, right? Underneath that is the pulsating luminosity of whatever we want to call it, kundalini, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So, again, ultimately, we want the whole thing to be so clear that the so-called light of awareness, it's like awareness is the light, or consciousness, let's call it consciousness. Consciousness is underneath all of that. The light of consciousness is underneath all of that. And we want that light of consciousness to move through the whole system, and everything is clear, everything is shining. That's like when they talk about sattva. Right, that's a sattvic state. Everything is so shiny and clear. It's like a crystal, or like the glasses. I was washing some mugs today, the glass mugs, and I think my rubber gloves are getting a little, just like it's time to put a new pair. So they make like a little, I don't know, it's not like shiny. And I was like, oh, time to change the... But then I thought, you know, I gotta make it really shiny. So I wasn't in the mood to change the gloves right then. So I really scrubbed it with more sponge and rubbed it, and then so it would shine. And that's what all the practice we do is really, it's about shining. Mm-hmm. It's about shining manas and citta, which tend to get muddy. They just get muddy. Partly because there's so much coming in and it's got to go somewhere. And partly because a lot of what's coming in, it registers, but we're not even aware of it. Bingo, right down into citta. Or it comes in, we're aware of it, we don't want to see it, we send it down, we repress it. You know the routine. Not to mention all the emotions that also happen to be sort of, they start lower, but they kind of find their way in because the ego just loves to appropriate, especially negative emotion. Give it something to feel sorry about itself for, and it's off and running. So, and that's the other thing about the ego. I mean, and that ahamkara, it's so interesting. It's a very active thing. And again, it's always just, if you think of this as this incredible field inside of yourself, part of it is conscious, part of it is unconscious. And the ego is just like this kid in a playground running around looking for the next thing he can identify with. Here's a thought, let me become this, you know? Here's an emotion, let me become this. Oh, here's an emotion, I don't want to feel this, let me shove this one down, you know, whatever it is. That's ahamkara just doing its thing. I. You know, anytime the sentence starts with I, ahamkara is kicked in. That's a perfectly fine thing when buddhi is calling the shots for ahamkara. But that's often not what happens. And so, for instance, in conversation, I mean, what started this whole article is actually an article I wrote many years ago after I had an encounter with someone at the Whole Earth Center. And I you know, friend of someone, I hadn't seen her in a while. I wasn't, no one in this room, don't worry. I wasn't feeling great. She asked, you know, the requisite question, you know how I feel about how are you? And I made the mistake of answering and saying, no, I'm not feeling great. And that was it. Off and running. Every, you know, essential oil, vitamin, Reiki, whatever that I should be doing so I wouldn't feel sick. And by the time she was done trying to fix me, I was so exhausted. I like couldn't get away from her. And I was so angry when I came home, I wrote this article. This is way, way back in the 90s, soon after I moved here. And it was called The Myth of the Big Fix. And they published it in that little Holistic Living magazine. And I've never forgotten that article. I always thought that was kind of a fun, interesting article. And so I decided, you know, I got to bring it up into the 21st century. And that's kind of how this all began. So, but in that moment, I just wasn't feeling well. And for whatever, because of whatever mishigas that she has, because in her belief system, which again is formed of manas, citta, and the ego going bonkers with all of that, the rule is if you practice yoga and live a healthy lifestyle, you're not supposed to be sick. I was sick. And that's not true anyway. No. You're just supposed to be what you are. But I think because it so violated her belief system, and it was a belief system that her ego is extremely identified with, right? Ahamkara is like really holding on to that one. Sick is not okay, especially if you have a healthy lifestyle. You can't be sick. So, and she happens to be someone who's struggled with illness for her whole bloody life. So, of course, I'm a mirror of everything in herself that she hates, right? In fact, it was illness that brought her to yoga. Well, that's true of a lot of people. So, Because she couldn't just be with me who wasn't feeling great. She had to try to fix me, which is another word for try to destroy me, right? Make it go away, push it away, kill it. Kill the sickness. Do not let it invade the sacred space of my being, right? Of course, what's happening on her end is it's all coming in anyway. And she's in this major reactive, defensive, pushing it away, repressing her own feelings, blah, 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 blah. Probably triggered big time her self-hatred that she hasn't been the most healthy person in the world. She could have stayed with that. She would have said, oh, I'm so sorry. God, that's awful. Why are you out? You need to go home. Go to bed. What are you doing? Can I get you something? Can I help you? You want me to just get your stuff and I'll drop it at your house for you? Go home, rest. But she couldn't do that. Need to do all the stuff, whatever it was, to make it go away. And I never forgot that conversation, because when I was so exhausted by the end of this conversation, I felt worse. And that's what we do to each other, you know? And you know, those of you who work with me, you know my whole thing is just whatever it is, just be with it. So feel lousy. If somebody comes to me who feels lousy, we'll be lousy together, you know? And what I was already understanding pretty well in those years, and have only come to understand it much better in these last 20 years, is that when we feel bad, we just need somebody to sit with us in the badness. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be fixed, we want company. Because part of feeling lousy is we feel alone. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to be alone in our suffering. We want somebody to be with us. It's lonely. Mm-hmm. Suffering is lonely. There's nothing like having a friend hang out in the suffering. But not in a yucky gossip on. I mean, sometimes gossip is great, you know, but you know what I mean. When we're really in a hard place, we need to know we're not alone there. We need to be seen. We need to be heard. We need to be listened to. She was not listening to me. She was actually pushing me away in the guise of trying to be a friend and trying to help me. So that experience 20-something years ago is what has, in many ways, you know, kind of formed one of the cornerstones of my work as a teacher. And it just has always driven home to me the importance of really listening to each other and again, listening to ourself. And I think the ego, that ahamkara, is a very, very tricky presence inside of us, and it's often, you know, like there's a thought in the manas area that's actually being influenced by the citta area. Like in her case, let's say the thought was, that doesn't sound good, but then that's the conscious, and then but the citta is just like, well, you've been sick your whole life, you know, you're just an awful person, you know, you're a phony, you're a fraud, how dare you teach yoga, you should hate yourself, you know, that kind of garbage. That's all unconscious. The ahamkara just tries to bypass all that unconscious energy so it can grab onto, let's see if we can fix her. But of course, as it's moving through the citta, it's picking up all that self-hatred. And so when it gloms on to the manas, it doesn't even come out, it doesn't come out helpful at all, because it's actually filled with her own toxicity that's been unconscious. This is the problem with so much that passes for conversation in our lives, with ourselves, with everyone we're in, you know, everyone in our lives. And again, I think much bigger, the whole environment. Everything. So is there a point? I mean, what is the point? The point is listening, you know, what is the point? The point is keep doing the internal processing work of making friends with everything inside, you know. That's how we wake up the unconscious. That's how the unconscious becomes conscious every time we meet something in that vast field of citta, and whatever it is, we just say, hello, you know, let me know you. Let me embrace you. Let me bring you into the family here where I can actually see you. And then ahamkar, it needs to really listen to buddhi. You know, in many ways, if you think about, I mean, they keep changing what they know about the brain, but if we just go to the sort of the basic neuro understanding, you know, they talk about the frontal lobes and the brainstem, and the brainstem is the old brain and the frontal lobes are the new brain. And in a way, in most of us, ahamkar is really pretty much hanging out in that brainstem. It's pretty much the fight and flight presence inside of us. That's pretty much how ahamkar, and that's why yoga, meditation, chanting, art making, athletics, so many walking, so many things that we do that we find to be uplifting. It's because consciousness moving through ahamkar, moving through the ego, isn't stuck in the brainstem. It moves into the frontal lobes. And when it moves into the frontal lobes, that's when buddhi is really coming into the mix, if we were going to put it in those terms. And all of these practices are really cultivating buddhi. If we put it in the terminology of masculine feminine, we could say that the ahamkar is the ego, it's the masculine, it's going out, and the buddhi is the deep feminine. It's the well of insight, wisdom. In its most simplistic, we just discriminate picture, people, room, rug, harmonium. In its much deeper state, it's like, whatever it may be. Yeah? So far, so good?
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So that's enough. Let's chant some more. Okay, so yeah, just take a moment and let yourself go inside. And maybe start by visualizing that inner sun we've been playing with now for so many months, and really feel that inner sun right at the core of your being. And breathing in from that incredible, extraordinary luminosity. Even if you don't actually see it, you know, just kind of imagine that it is there, the inner sun, right at the center, just pulsating light 360 degrees around. And then kind of imagine your own version of buddhi. And then bring in your, however you imagine, citta. And then, of course, manas. And then take that sense of ego, the ahamkar, the eye-maker, and plop it right there. Put it right there in the center. So rather than running around appropriating and identifying every little thing that moves through manas and citta and comes up from buddhi, it's just okay to just sit still and listen and watch and see and hear and feel and touch, even taste, without that kind of identification, appropriation, grabbing onto way that it can be before it begins to wake up, before it begins to identify with that sun source, and to allow the wisdom of buddhi to really permeate it. Just kind of hang out with that little dharana.